Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck Tuckians? What the fuck Greekins? What the fucksicans? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome if you have not been here before. On the show today, Seth Meyers, one of the missing links of the SNL. Well, obviously, there's dozens of people that have been on SNL, but I've done Seth's show. He's a nice fella. We talked about some stuff. We talked about riding it out, locking in and realizing your limitations, acknowledging your limitations perhaps is a better way to put it. It was a good conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. There's no way to say he's not a decent fella, that Seth Meyers with all those S's. So what else? I've got big news. Big news that I'm afraid to utter aloud. That is, I'm afraid to speak it because it's one of those things many of you know. I did not think a lot of things were going to happen. And a lot of things happened that I had let go of, which is about realizing your limitations, or at least being realistic about where the fuck you are in your life for a second. Long story short, 700 and some odd episodes, short, I didn't anticipate a lot of things. And but I will say this, Mark Maron will be performing stand-up comedy at Carnegie Hall on November 4th for the New York Comedy Festival. The pre-sale will run from Wednesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. Eastern Time to Sunday, August 14th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Tickets go on sale for the general public Monday, August 15th at 10 a.m. And that's happening. I am playing Carnegie Hall. It is insane. I would never have thought. I hope I can fill it. I feel like I can. I did all right at BAM last year, But on some level, it is it is just a big venue, but it's fucking Carnegie Hall, and I'm feeling the pressure. So if you were wondering why I've been so diligent about working on my stand-up, that's why. That is why. Because, frankly, I want to have my shit as together as possible for Carnegie Hall. And the weird thing, well, I don't even know how to process it. I'm just trying not to focus on it. I believe Nate Bargatze will be opening for me. I've reached out to Nate, who is one of my favorite comics, at this juncture in the history of the medium, of the craft, of the form. And he's into it, so I think that's going to happen. So it's going to be me and Nate at Carnegie Hall. I'm putting together the act for Carnegie Hall, and then I guess after that I can just stop, right? I can quit. I've done everything that I thought I would never do. Here's the fucked up thing about the life is that all those years of spite and envy and struggle and fuck that guy and why can't I have this and why am I not on that and why am I would not have been able to do it. I would not have been able to function given the opportunities. It would not have gone well, and it's weird. Sometimes people know better. You don't know. You know, if you're as stupidly proud and selfishly myopic as I am, you think you're ready for everything. I can do that. I'm ready. Let's go. It's the act of desiring and fighting and competing and struggling. Where? Give me mine. Where's my entitlement? But usually, a lot of times, the people who are in charge of making decisions to do things with you know better. You might not be ready. There was no way I could have handled it at any other point in my life. Not even last year. And I spent a long time seeing my peers do that venue and do other things. And I've spoke about this fucking so much. And all that jealousy and all that aggravation and spite, what you should be doing is working on your shit. Whatever it is you think you can do, all the energy you're putting into saying, fuck, man, where's mine? Why that guy? How come I didn't get you? Just try to put that energy into the other thing. But sadly, I also did that on stage. That was my voice for years. But it is not now. And I'm going to say it out loud again with my name involved. Mark Maron, me, will be playing Carnegie Hall for the New York Comedy Festival on November 4th. Holy shit. Another thing that's happening today is August 8th, correct? Tomorrow, August 9th, I will be, if something doesn't fucking go horribly wrong today, if somebody does not hold me down and dump alcohol into my mouth or lock me in a room and gas it with weed smoke or turn me upside down and suspend me and dump cocaine into my nose, tomorrow, August 9th, I will be 17 years sober. My name's Mark. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. 17 fucking years sober tomorrow. I don't know how this shit happened. I don't know. I do know that my memory is diminishing. that everything's becoming a large smear of faces and cars and, you know, women and geographical locations. Can't place things. Things pop up here and there. But yeah, 17 years sober tomorrow, August 9th. Carnegie Hall, me, November 4th. I couldn't have done one without the other. That's for goddamn sure. And I also, look, I get a lot of email from you people, and I appreciate it. I know that that this show has been helpful to a lot of people struggling with that shit. And it's hard at first, and it gets easier. Life doesn't change, but not doing drugs and drinking does get easier if you get off the shit. So that's the good news. Can you fucking believe it? I can't fucking believe it. See, I don't even like saying this because then you're sort of like, the other shoe's going to drop. Yeah, how do I get rid of that part? The like, everything's going great, but what if, oh shit. How do I get rid of my internal buzzkill device? Had a spontaneous bit of closure last night at the Comedy Store, the greatest comedy club on earth. Adam Egit, the dude who books it, is bringing in people, bringing in the new guard, bringing in popular comedians to the haunted old fucking castle of comedy. So I look at the schedule for the Comedy Store and Kumail Nanjiani's on the schedule and he don't work there. And I guess you guys didn't know, but I mean, maybe if you were sensitive to the situation and watched my television show, Marin, on IFC, Mad Mark, season 3, episode 6. Well, it was basically a fictionalized meltdown show and I lose it on the guy playing Kumail. And that really happened. And that was years ago already. And it was never resolved. Basically, what happened is I was doing a show there at Nerd Melt. And it was actually the last fucking show I ever did in that goddamn place. whatever happened between me and Kumail stopped me entirely from doing alternative rooms. Entirely. I just do the Comedy Store when I'm in town. They give me a lot of work. I get my work done, or I do the Steve Allen Theater on my own terms and, you know, work out shit. I don't go to the Laugh Factory. Fuck the Laugh Factory. Fuck the Improv. Fuck Nerd Melt. I go to the Comedy Store. But the alternative thing, this just detached me from all of it for some reason. I just turned my back on those venues and decided that I'm going back to my roots. I'm going back to what I started to do. I'm going back to a real comedy club, and that's how it goes. And now Kumail Nanjiani is on the schedule at the real comedy club that is my home, the Comedy Store. And my first thought was like, what's he doing there? What's, you know, I mean, a lot of those guys are working there now. Mulaney's there, and Nick Kroll's been coming by. And I love those guys. These guys are all funny guys. But me and Kumail had a problem, and I was like, why is he in my house? I don't go to his house anymore. What the fuck is happening? So I had that, but it wasn't that. I didn't really obsess about it. Like, I didn't, this wasn't an active bit of sort of like, I didn't feel that there was an injustice at hand. I mean, what happened was, not unlike the episode of the show, I went on stage after he and Jonah Ray, you know, kind of did their rambling thing. But I got on stage when they brought me up, and I took a shot at him. I busted some balls. I said, you know, I made fun of him. And then I got off stage, and he was sitting in there. He goes, you know, you can't make fun of me on my show. And I said, are you fucking serious? Are you really saying that to me? And this is how I remember it. And I'm like, you really serious? He's like, yeah, it's my show. You can't make fun of me on it. And I was like, fuck you. You know, you fucking baby. Yeah, I can't bust your balls on. You can't take it. Fuck you. And I called him a fucking baby, and I stormed out of the room, slamming the door like a fucking baby. And I said, fuck it. I'm not doing, you know, I'm not, you know, cross me off the list. This big, dramatic, prideful baby bullshit. Man. But anyways, it stuck. And I didn't go back there. And I didn't talk to him. We unfollowed each other on Twitter. And this was over a year. I mean, this has been years. So this sat there. And we wrote that episode of Marin about that. About that incident. Almost exactly. And I saw it as my way of apologizing to Kumail without apologizing. And I fucking asked him if he wanted to play himself in the episode. And he did not. Or he said he couldn't. Well, it doesn't matter. He didn't. So last night, I go to the Comedy Store. I even forget that he's on the show. And once I get there, I walk into the original room and I see him sitting there. He looks at me. He goes, hey. I look at him. I go, what's up? And he goes, is it done? I think is what he said. And I go, yeah. Then we walked out in the hallway. We hugged and, you know, and it's over. But it wasn't even that loaded. I was happy to see him. I tweeted later. I said, me and Kumail hugged it out, FYI. He said the walls are, yeah, something about the walls. Now we tore the wall down, and then I tweeted detente, and then we both followed each other again on Twitter. So there you have it. The saga of Mark Maron and Kumail Nanjiani now ends. A secret saga that some of you knew was real is over, and I feel okay about it. I don't know why I'm saying that like, you know, you should be proud of me. Fucking baby. You know what I mean? I'm better, though. I'm better. And I love that talk with Eric Andre. That was helpful, too. But there's a lot fewer of these. There's very few left. Oh, before I forget, Eric Andre and I talked a bit, but not really in any detail, but it was a little loaded about the writer Jim Goad. And he emailed me feeling a bit misrepresented. So if you are interested in following up on that, you can go to jimgoad.net. There's very little that goes on in his life or in his mind that goes undocumented. It is challenging. It is a dark rabbit hole, not for the faint of mind or heart, but I wanted to make sure that he is represented, and I guess he can do that best himself. So Seth Meyers is here, and you can watch his show. It's Late Night with Seth Meyers on at 12:30 every weeknight, right after the Tonight Show. It's a very pleasant hang, and it was nice to talk to him. You want to listen to it? Because I'll let you listen to it right now.
I don't know if I told you this, because I was an intern at Comedy Central summer of 95, and I did a lot of watching of short attention span theater.
When I did it?
Yeah.
How did? Oh my God! Where are you? But at Comedy Central, not at HBO Downtown. So you're up in the office.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. You watched me miraculously string together a bunch of promotional clips into TV shows.
Yeah, and that's the department I worked in was just cutting promos for shows. So you were cutting old sketches into a show, and then we were cutting that into promos. I wasn't.
And that was before Broadway video. That was before any...
Yeah.
How old were you when you did that?
Well, that's right before my senior year of college, so I must have been 20 years old.
So you were gunning for show business all along.
Well, I was a radio TV film major at Northwestern, so I tried to get an internship, and yeah. Comedy Central seemed like a fun place to work.
You seem like a very well-adjusted person. It bothers me.
Yeah, I'm fairly well-adjusted.
Like, I don't know what to do with it. when you were doing Update, or when I knew about you, when you were someone I knew, I was like, how's that normal fucker get to be the king of SNL? How does that happen? The normal
guy.
It's
not fair. I agree. I agree. Trust me, I will say I spent the whole time thinking the normal fucker wasn't going to
oh,
get
really?
It either.
Okay, so, well, that makes you more like us.
Okay.
That there were problems inside that don't come out in front.
Well, I just felt normal at a place where I felt I was surrounded by exceptional.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. I get it. So wait, so where did you, where was the upbringing? What happened? Where did you grow up?
I was born near Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, but we grew up in New Hampshire.
Really?
Yeah. Same, pretty much the same town as Sarah Silverman and Adam Sandler. Yeah.
But you didn't know them.
I didn't know them. I knew people who knew Sarah because she's only a couple years older than me.
Right.
But I do remember thinking it was statistically impossible that three people from my part of New Hampshire would be on SNL. Once Sarah got on, I assumed, we'll never.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you were working the numbers? You're like, I'm out.
I just thought, no, it's just a long shot.
No, God will not allow that. The great.
Why would they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The great connection of coincidences. Serendipity is, it's over. It's played out in that part.
New Hampshire doesn't get that many.
Well, what part of New Hampshire is that?
I'm from a town called Bedford, but I went to high school in Manchester, which is Sanders town.
That's like the town. There's only a few in New Hampshire.
There really
it's pretty
are.
Though, right?
Yeah, it was great. It was a perfectly, it's pastoral to some degree, but it's really suburban more than anything else.
Right. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one younger brother.
That's it?
Yeah.
How old is that kid, your brother?
He's 2 years younger than me. Josh, he lives out here. He's an actor
Josh
and a writer.
Josh and Seth. How are you Josh and Seth, but not 100% Jews?
Isn't that weird? Well, my father's father's Jewish, and he married a Catholic lady.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom, pure shiksa.
Yeah.
And
but you get Seth and Josh? I mean, Jews are afraid to name their kids that Jew.
I know. Well, that was the thing. My dad, do you know the book North Dallas 40?
Yeah, I know the movie.
Yeah, so...
I love that movie.
One of the characters is Seth Maxwell.
Yeah.
And my dad was reading that book when my mom was pregnant with me, and he just liked the name Seth. I don't think he thought... how Jewy it would make.
Was that Mac Davis's character or Nick Nolte's character?
I think it's Nolte, but now I can't. No, maybe it's Mac Davis.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's where it comes from.
It
has nothing
from.
To do with the Bible or Jews. It's North Dallas 40.
And it was funny, growing up in New Hampshire, it wasn't until I got to college where I realized how I was around more Jews in college than I was in high school.
Yeah, it happens
and
in
that's
cities.
When you realize, that was the first time I realized, the rest of my life, everyone's going to
think you're Jewish?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're going to approach you like you're one of them until you
say
I'm not.
It was lovely. Well, that's the lovely part is how happy people are to find out that you're Jewish. Like, that was great.
Jews.
Yeah, Jews are always looking for more.
Yeah. Jew?
Yeah.
Okay. Now we can talk. There's a shorthand.
Yes.
So when you were younger, though, when did your interest in comedy start?
Really early. My parents, my dad especially, was a huge fan.
You would go, you went to Fanny Hall.
But a lot of like listening to Steve Martin albums and Richard Pryor albums. My dad had comedy albums, we would listen to those.
Is your dad still around?
Yeah.
How old is he?
I was born in 48.
So he was like, he's actually like almost like a boomer almost, just the beginning of it in a way. So he was part of all that.
He was. They were in Chicago. They both went to Northwestern, so they would go to Second City shows. They were really
Green Street
that.
Tavern? Did they do that stuff?
Like, they did.
Like, were they like Shelly Berman or Mort Saul?
I missed that. I think went to Second City. I think like they didn't quite dig for it as much as if there was an institution in place, they would go there.
So they went and saw the old Second City people.
Yeah. And then I even remember when we went out to Northwestern to take me out to look at it, that was where they took me.
To the Second City?
Yeah. So that was something I did when I was, whatever, you know, 18 years old.
Who'd you see? Do you remember? Anybody?
Yeah, Colbert, Carell.
Really? You saw that bunch?
I did. It was really crazy. Because then they kind of both disappeared for a while. Not really, but until they were on The Daily Show. And when they turned up, it was, oh, hey, those guys are really great.
Well, you knew Colbert then if you were at Comedy Central at that time, because he was on Exit 57,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Exit 57, though, even working at Comedy Central, that was a show that, it was so brief.
So, wait, what's your brother end up doing? Is he in show business?
Yeah, he was on Mad TV for a couple of years. He was on a year of That 70s Show. He's on a show on Amazon right now called Red Oaks.
Josh Myers.
And he writes as well.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we grew up really close. We did a lot of stuff together.
Did you do comedy team thing?
We did sort of in high school. And then
the Myers brothers?
With other people, sort of more part of a troupe. And then we went to college together. And then we both ended up out in Amsterdam working for this theater called Boom Chicago.
In Amsterdam, the country?
Yeah,
in Holland?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Let me understand. So what's your dad do?
My dad is in finance. But he's also...
That's vague. So he's a money guy.
He's the funny guy. He's the funniest person in any room.
The funny money guy?
He's not really... Yeah, he's the funny money guy. It's on right after... He's on right after Jim Cramer.
Yep.
No, but he's a really funny person. He's a fantastic storyteller.
Yeah.
Incredible. Like, every sort of dinner party I'm ever at, my whole youth, like, my dad was the funny one.
Right, just overwhelming everybody.
Yeah.
No room to be funny.
Well... You had to really wait your time. When you had a shot, you had to make sure you didn't waste it.
Which is where you develop your skills as a talk show host.
Yeah.
Waiting.
Waiting.
That's a lot of waiting involved.
There is.
There is sometimes, right?
Yeah.
I've learned to wait. No, I'm not good at it.
It's really important, though.
Oh, no, to listen and wait. And, like, you know, it's weird. The first time you decide not to make a joke that you can is a big moment for a funny person.
Just 2 weeks ago, there was a show where I walked off and I thought, what was wrong with me today?
Really?
That I just kept jumping. There was something.
Who was the guest?
I can't even remember, but it was all the guests. I just kept like jumping in to say something as if I don't get to do it every day. That's what makes waiting easy.
Well, let's track that day. Maybe you were like, sort of like, is anyone watching the show? Am I not doing it right?
Yeah, or
like, maybe I got to get in there more.
Maybe the monologue was flat and I didn't get my laughs that I needed to move on. So I was trying to steal them from other people.
Yeah. But it's a weird moment it's a very thrilling moment to decide not to make a joke.
I've
never really talked about it with anybody because I don't know that, like, I noticed it as much, because you only notice it if you're, I mean, I imagine you did but on SNL it's different, but in improv it's probably part of it. There's a moment where you're like, you got to let them have that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do better, or mine's redundant.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to do it. Or, like, you know, like, it's not necessary to win this one.
Mm-hmm. And nothing, you're right in that nothing is less satisfying than the lateral move.
Right.
I can also do what you just did. hey, audience, look.
There's no way not to look like an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, yeah, it was unnecessary.
We probably notice it more than anyone else,
mm-hmm.
because I do think we live in a society where people do lateral moves all the time in social interactions.
Yeah, they glom.
But, so it is hard.
Yeah.
But it is lovely. I think that, and you probably discovered this even earlier than I did, but people... The problem with being interesting is that the audience doesn't make a noise.
Right.
If every time they were engaged that way and they were going, ooh, then you would never make
jokes. I've used that to rationalize my entire lack of success throughout my career. Is that, like, I may not be funny, but I'm compelling. You enjoy watching me no matter what.
It's a very good era for compelling.
Yeah. I think
I really truly believe it.
Finally, this culture has come around to compelling. Yeah, because, like, I'm very hard on myself about my jokes and about whether or not they're finished and whether or not the tag is good enough, or if there is a tag. And instead of really work them properly, I'll be like, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty compelling there.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay not to have closure. I mean, you know, there's not closure in everything.
Especially once the audience
also
understands that that's what you're doing.
Right. Oh, I get it. He's not being funny.
Right. Oh, this is tonight. Tonight's not going to be about closure.
Yeah. Or punchlines or necessarily humor. But so, well, I guess I was just trying to establish that, like, when you grew up, like, comfortably, you weren't in the poor part of New Hampshire. So, because, like, when I hear, like, two brothers going to Amsterdam to do a show, I'm like, yeah, a little freedom, these guys.
Oh, we really did. I mean, our parents were so supportive. They came to everything we did. My mom was a theater major at Northwestern. She ended up being a school teacher. So she had a real performer spirit as well.
What grade? What?
She taught middle school French for, you know, I think.
At a public school?
Yeah, about 30 years.
So many teacher kids I talked to.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice. I would hope that a teacher would be supportive at home and like, you know, encourage whatever the creativity the person wants to do, the kid.
My mother is as supportive as you could ask. She's my brother and I have never done anything that's been anything less than an A+ for her.
Oh, really?
Whereas my dad, who's also incredibly supportive, he's the one that's judgmental and will give you notes and will tell you that wasn't your best.
You hearing from him a lot?
Oh, yeah.
For the show.
Less now, but early SNL, I heard from him a lot.
Really?
To a point that at one time I did have to say, hey, I also am aware it's not going great. I'm there every day.
When you were on Update or before?
No, before.
Oh, so when you were just writing?
Back in the struggle. Well, I started as a cast member at SNL.
Yeah.
And then I didn't become a credited writer. I mean, everybody in the cast writes, but until about my fifth or sixth year. But I was just trying to write myself onto the show. And I just remember my dad walking down the street with him, because he'll be in New York every now and then for business. So I get to see him. And he was saying, you know what I've noticed is recurring characters tend to be very helpful. And it was that thing of, I just want you to know, Dad, that I have also come to that conclusion, and I'm just not good at them. It wasn't that it hadn't occurred to me.
And no matter what level of success, through advice, they will diminish you.
Yeah. Well, the diminishing thing there is that it's one that I don't have recurring characters. The more insulting thing is that had never occurred to me
that
as a thinking man.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's it. That's exactly it. Because I still get that from my dad. You know, why don't you talk to, Bill Maher, or maybe talk to Charlie Rose about getting a show like his.
Yeah.
Like, there's a sort of, they don't understand the business quite, and they don't realize they're being shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that the last person you go to get a show like theirs is that person.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, Charlie, why don't you move over? I think your time is up.
You seem to be the person to talk to about being direct competition.
I don't know if it's, I have to, as I get older, I just want to believe that it's all with the right spirit.
Oh, 100%. There's been no malice from my parents throughout any part of my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
You sound like you're being paid to say that.
It's weird. I didn't think of it until you
just
said,
now?
Well, yeah. But I really, I mean, again, they are,
I guess malice would be a hard word.
Yeah, malice, yeah.
For anybody. But slight passive-aggressive ego battles with parents are not... But I'm not suggesting that.
No.
I mean, I'm just saying that, like, malice is a strong word.
I think my dad, because of the fact that everyone thinks he's really funny, because he is, I think he takes great pride in the fact that...
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my dad's reluctantly starting to
that's
take
good.
Pride. It's nice.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you do some things with your brother in high school.
Yeah.
Is there music involved?
No, just... never.
Okay, well, that's good.
I just had no skill for it ever.
No skill for music.
Yeah. I love it, but I don't.
Yeah. And then, all right, so you graduate, and then you go look at Northwestern, you see Carell and Colbert. Are you thinking about SNL?
No, no, no. I wanted to be a director. I wanted to...
Film director.
Yeah. And so I applied to schools that had good film programs, and I ended up at Northwestern for that. And our new student week at Northwestern, I saw the Northwestern improv troupe perform.
What were they called?
Meow. And
were you happy with that name for the
I group? Wasn't. No. Yeah. It's a spoof.
Yeah.
When Gary Marshall was on, he mentioned WAMU, which was sort of the all school big, and so Meow was a spoof on that.
Oh, really?
So at least it came from something.
Right. That's right. You and Gary are alumni.
Yeah. Julia was in Meow, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Was she?
Years
oh, that's
before
right.
Me,
we talked about that. I don't know if she named it, though.
I don't think she did. I think she was smarter than me. She didn't drop it.
No, I like Meow. So you're at Northwestern, which is a Chicago school, so improv is a known thing.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe this group, judging by the alum, you know, had a little traction somehow, or that you at least knew you were in an improv town.
Definitely saw these guys perform that new Student Week immediately. That was the, I thought, oh, I think I can do that.
Yeah. Were they attached to the theater program, or they were, or was it more of a general?
It was an independent thing. You didn't have to be in theater to audition for it. Yeah. And every year it had a student director who would pick 8 students to be in the group.
Different student director.
Different student director every year. Uh-huh. And I auditioned for it for 3 years without getting in.
Really?
So I only did it.
Not till your senior year?
Yeah.
Holy shit. That's kind of rough.
And I never thought they were wrong. Like, when I would go see the shows, it would always be 4 guys and 4 girls. I would look at the 4 guys who they had picked.
Yeah, and you're like, I can't do
no,
it.
They were all better than I was.
Well, yeah. What were you doing?
Well, they were, it was just a group of people a year older than me, and they were, you know.
Improvising?
They were improvising. They were
writing
fantastic
sketches.
Improvisers. Their shows would be sketch and improv.
Yeah.
Like, they're very much, like, based on the Second City model, I would say.
Right.
But
did,
then...
Do people go to their shows? Were they popular
they
on
were
campus?
Packed.
Oh, really?
They were
okay.
Rock stars.
Okay. All right.
And I liked that part,
yeah,
too.
Sure.
I was drawn to that.
Yeah.
But I started going into Chicago, going to Improv Olympic and taking improv classes at the same time that I was sort of...
Where at?
Improv Olympic. So that's
the other one.
IO now.
Yeah.
Sharna Halperin's place.
Uh-huh.
Del Close's place.
Yeah. Del Close was Improv Olympic?
Yeah.
I should know that.
Yeah.
That he's the one who started that? That was his offshoot?
Yeah, he and Sharna. Yeah.
Del Close. Did you meet him?
I didn't.
Was he already dead?
Is he dead? I think he is. Yeah, he is. I just missed him. He would have been what was level 5 at this school.
It's so amazing to me that, like, you know, because I've talked to so many people that there's this the Chicago influence, man.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal, and it was a really exciting... You would be able to go down... to take your classes, and then it was pretty, I think if you took class, shows might have even been free.
Yeah.
But you would just hang out and see people that turned out to later be like Amy Poehler or Tina Fey. And
you saw them where?
At Improv Olympic, just doing shows.
They were IO people?
Yeah. They were IO people.
God, I'm sure I know that. I can't remember everything.
IO was like a place people worked before they got, you didn't get paid at IO.
Oh, so you're heading towards Second City.
Yeah,
hopefully.
it was like the AAA for
right,
Second
oh, right.
City.
I get it, right, farm team.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were seeing them. You saw Tina and
and Dratch. Dratch.
Yeah.
I saw Dratch on Second City be funnier in a show than I've ever seen. Like, pop out of a show more than anything.
Anybody?
Yeah. Crazy. Horatio.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, I was just in awe of all of them.
So your brother's with you?
No,
at
my
IO?
Brother...
What's the age difference?
2 years.
It's just like me and my brother. He's 2.5, though. 2.5.
So I finished school and was doing IO. I'd done the 1 year of Meow, and that had sort of put in my head that I wanted to keep doing this. My goal was Second City. That's really what I wanted to do more than
that
anything
That was a short-term goal. That you didn't see past that.
I really didn't. And they would sort of audition. I would maybe every year, every 6 months.
Were you doing characters?
No. I was doing a two-person show.
Yeah.
And with this girl named Jill Benjamin, my old comedy partner, and we used to say that, like, just check me out during the course of the show. This is when I was, 27 years old. And I would say, like, over the course of the show, you'll see me play characters anywhere between 26 and 28 years old. Because at no point in my career have I had range.
Yeah.
And I think as an improviser, all my characters were just, like, slight variations of...
On you?
Of me, yeah.
So what do you think your big comic strength is?
Well, I think I could write really fast as an improviser.
Yeah.
I think premise and structure and good jokes.
Yeah.
But I ended up out in Amsterdam. So these guys started this like...
Okay, so you graduate college, you do IO for a while, you don't get into Second City.
I don't, right.
You tried.
I tried. I auditioned.
Yeah.
And I think like I was probably on a short list for maybe the next year.
Uh-huh.
But that was the thing about Chicago. Like you really had to like stick around.
Oh yeah, well, it's not unlike stand up where you had to pay your fucking dues, you had to show up at the things, other guys had to be like, he's a guy,
yeah,
and then you know, then you get your shot,
yeah,
if you hang out long enough.
And it's I always remember that the thing about auditioning for Second City is it would be a small group of people, not a group of people you picked,
yeah,
it was not self selecting,
right.
And then you would maybe have one or two shots to do an improv scene, and you're with somebody else whose skills could be anywhere from a
just
0 to 10.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just like, you know, you're just the default straight guy.
Yeah. Or they're just dragging you down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a couple ways it could go.
How does that work?
Well, you know, you go out and you just realize somebody is not that good at improvising.
Oh, so that's the other side, the not good guy.
Yeah.
The guy who's floundering.
And then you just can't elevate your game past those limitations. But then we, a friend of mine, this guy, Pete Gross, we saw an audition notice for this place, Boom Chicago, which was some Chicago guys started an improv theater in Amsterdam. And it was only in its third year now. It's still going.
Still going.
And we auditioned for that.
Same guys,
yeah.
They're there?
Yeah, Chicago guys.
They just stayed
guys.
There?
Yeah, they all married Dutch women, and they just...
Really?
Yeah. And they just...
Boom Chicago.
And there have been... Jordan Peele from Key and Peele went through there. Sudeikis was out there at the same time. Ike Barinholtz, who's a really funny guy, was out there.
In Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
But most of these guys, I assume, are sort of like, this is my semester abroad.
It was a year contract when you did it. Most people ended up staying for longer, for two, because we did shows in a 250-seat theater. They sold really well. You got to do about 200 shows a year as a performer. And living in Amsterdam was fantastic. I mean, it was the most fun of my life.
It was.
Yeah. I mean, mostly because it was the age that you're just more likely to be
happier. How old are you, like 28?
I think I was there from 25 to 27.
2 years, 25 to 27. Yeah. You're young,
mm-hmm.
Excited.
Yep.
Smoking a lot of hash.
I realized I don't love smoking weed there, but I love drinking,
sure.
You know, Heineken from the tap. It wasn't like,
right.
There was plenty of
debauchery. It's pretty
there. It's beautiful.
And you went to the Van Gogh Museum?
I don't know if I did.
Didn't make it,
there.
So right. So
I go back a lot, and I've gone since.
You go back a lot?
Well, I do. I have close friends there, and I love it. So
the guys from Chicago who marry Dutch women.
Yeah.
So you and your wife go there.
Yeah,
and spend it.
I went a lot more without my wife than with her.
Yeah,
I think we
got to do your drinking somewhere, right?
Got to do.
You seem like a pretty clean cat, you know. Like you got a good reputation here.
So I got
to sneak off to Amsterdam.
Got to go abroad. There have been a few times where I was really messed up in Amsterdam, and someone came up to say, and you just realize, oh, you're not the only American there.
Right.
I'm really messed up in someone saying, oh, hey, I'm a huge fan. Can I?
Yeah. Or else like, hey, dude, you know, you're making us look bad.
Yeah, that's true. I never made us look as bad as some of the Americans there.
That's fascinating to me. So you know these guys that have now been there for over a decade.
More than that now. They started it in, 97, something like that.
Like 20 years.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
So they're like 45-year-old dudes.
Yeah.
And they just built a life for them in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And they have kids with Dutch people.
They have Dutch kids.
Dutch kids, and they speak two languages, maybe.
They do.
And they just keep hiring young people from the States?
Yep. And it's a grind. Like, running a theater is a grind. But they still love it so much.
But it's a big business, so they all do all right. They live in nice houses in Amsterdam?
They do pretty good. And a big part of it is they do a lot of corporate stuff, because there aren't a lot of, like,
all around Europe?
Mostly, you know, they do all around Europe.
Because
there's not that thing
right.
of, like, that kind of comedy where, hey, we'll come and, like, you help message and be funny in that American
improvisers
way.
Can do that easily.
They really can.
Yeah, like at a convention or at a corporate retreat.
Yeah, a lot of retreats.
Yeah, and I guess with improvisers, it's easier than comics who begrudgingly get that list of, that's the boss and this is what we to do here. But with improvisers, they're like, great.
Yeah,
we need this.
We
shit.
Were going to ask for suggestions anyway.
Exactly.
If you want to give them to us ahead of time,
it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
I just like the idea of people like just sort of finding themselves like in another country and deciding to like, well, this is it. I'm going to live here. And it seems exotic to me.
It was
interesting.
I think I could have ended up in Chicago forever. I really loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could have. I was close to saying, oh, I could just do this. I really love Amsterdam.
Work with these guys, yeah.
And there was this girl, Jill Benjamin, who was, like I mentioned her before, but we were out there at the same time, and we were doing a lot of stuff at the theater, and she was the one who said, I think we have to leave, because I think we're going to hit the ceiling of what we can accomplish here, because there weren't other jobs.
Right, no, you would be doing that.
Yeah.
And there's a certain type of person that's sort of like, I'm okay just turning this shit out every week.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not, I guess the challenges are different. There's a difference between a creative person that's searching to do something more with their creativity all the time and somebody who is like, we can do this every week.
I feel like I'm really a little bit of both.
Yeah, no.
Because I was really...
You're doing a thing every night.
Yeah. I mean, I ended up at one of them. And I was at SNL never thinking I got to get out of here. I was,
right.
This is great. I like this. Funny people here. So I was very lucky to have someone as a with the ambition of my partner at the time.
But also you were able to find out new things about what you were capable of within the structure of SNL. Like it seems like if you were just a cast member, like,
oh, yeah.
You know, like you had some power, you had production power and, you know, you had to manage people after a certain point. So you rose through the ranks a bit.
And I think for being a writer, like doing writing more than performing at the show, like that kind of never gets old because you're going to go write anywhere,
right,
somewhere else. And SNL basically is like having whatever writing job you want each week to be. Mm-hmm. I think for cast members, I get how somebody like, you know, Kristen Wiig or Bill Hader after 7 years can say, oh, I'm just out.
Right. Like, and also they've, left. You know, they've built up enough cultural capital to do bigger things in a way.
Yeah, of course.
If I don't know if I've ever used that phrase. Cultural capital.
Very nice.
It's pretty good, right?
And I think cultural capital is what SNL turns out probably more than any other show.
Absolutely. So, all right. So you're in Amsterdam.
Yep.
You're drinking Heineken's out of the tap.
Yeah.
You're doing improvs. You probably have moments where you're like, I did this riff the other day. Like, yeah. I'm doing this improv again.
Yeah, similar. Because the most rewarding part of that show was it was like Second City. There was sketch writing. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of that. But it was the improv was a lot of it was short form improvising,
right.
Which has a tendency when you do a lot of reps to feel redundant.
Right.
You know?
But you're learning how to write, basically.
Yeah.
Throughout all this.
And, you know, learning how to sort of strip away sort of pop culture references that would work in the States that don't work in front of a Dutch audience.
Right.
And that was kind of nice too, I think.
Yeah. But like the education of comedy writing came from not like class or school, but actually just
reps
and listening to jokes and, you know, like learning joke structure.
Yep.
Sketch structure.
That was very helpful for that. But that real education for me just took place at SNL. I mean, I think I was okay, but you just, that thing of sitting down every week and hearing 40 sketches be read.
Yeah, it's baffling to me that, like, how some sketches work. Like, you know, because I'm not, like, I don't know if I have ever thought about it as much as I've thought about it after talking to people doing it, but they have their own life, you know, that, like, either they're character-driven or maybe they're comedy-driven, but if you think in terms of comedy logic, like, on the page, a lot of sketches that are character-driven don't even add up.
No. Well, that was when you used to read things before the table read.
Right.
You know, before you understood what a Maya Rudolph could do.
Right, right.
You would say, well, best of luck with this. Yeah. I don't like your chances based on the first read.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
they just
destroy. Yeah.
So so you come back from Amsterdam, then what happens? Is that when you become you did the internship in college.
Yeah, that was in college. Yeah. So I come back 2 years. I come back after 2 years and start doing this show called Pickups and Hiccups with Joe Benjamin. And this was this...
Where's she now?
She's out here. She's married to John Henson. You know John Henson?
I do know John Henson.
So they're really? Married with a couple kids.
Everyone, kids. You just had one.
Just had one, yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like you waited long enough.
I did, 42.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't look 42.
Thank you.
How old's your wife?
32.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So... No, that's reasonable.
Yeah, it's within reason. It's on the edge of reason.
You know, I've gone unreasonable.
Yeah.
It doesn't last long. It's not the greatest thing.
If I was not with my beautiful wife, and thank God I am, I'm sure I'd be unreasonable.
Yeah. Good. So, all right, so you do the pick and what?
Pickups and Hiccups.
Yeah, with Jill.
Yeah.
Off Broadway.
It was in Chicago, and it became like a very small, but like local hit.
Oh, really?
We did it for a while, and we were doing
it. What was the angle?
It was a sort of sketch improv show about relationships.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And
so
then,
it was specific, and couples could go on Valentine's Day, and you do a special Valentine's Day show.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then we did it at this Chicago Improv Festival, and I was really lucky. This woman who worked in the talent department at SNL was there.
Who?
Just randomly. Ayala Cohen was her name. Is her name still. And she saw the show and reached out for me to send in an audition tape. And that sort of started the process.
And you had not even been thinking about that? Or?
No. Fully focused on Second
on
City.
On Pickups and Hiccups.
Yeah,
and
I didn't think.
And getting into Second City still.
Yeah, and then, I mean, had hoped, and I saw Second City as like, and then maybe after Second City, because that was the era that Tina had just left for SNL. Probably.
So you still thought you had to go through Second City.
I did,
And you did not have a relationship with Tina Fey at the time?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So it's just you and Jill, pickups and hiccups.
Yep.
Chicago Improv Fest.
Yep.
You get a call. Someone approaches you.
I get a call.
Ayala, what's her name? Ayala?
Ayala Cohen.
Ayala Cohen. Yeah. I know. I've met her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And she's like, we need a tape.
We need a tape. And it's so funny to think back to, which it feels, it's not that, it's not ancient history, but I had to find a friend who had a digital camera.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was a little tape, right. And then I had to find a place that would
whose
transfer
living
it.
Room, whose living room are you going to shoot it in, or just shoot it in the theater?
Shot it in front of like a chest of drawers, yes. Just this flat, like the lighting is so, and again, I think the lighting was just two desk lamps. One is the key and one is the fill, but they just, you know, just blasting heat on my face.
I'll never forget this time where we used to work for this company that used to book stand-up, and they get all these audition tapes, and we got hold of one, and it was a guy like in a basement doing jokes, and he had must have had a friend dropping a phonograph needle on a laugh track record. So the guy would do the joke, and he would just drop in like, ah! And he pulled the needle, but you heard the needle dropping. It was one of the best things I ever saw in my life.
Oh,
so you do brutal. This horrible tape.
I do the horrible tape.
What
think
do you
that's
do on
the end
it?
Of it. They had said, here's, I will sometimes say, I love when people give me specific rules.
Yeah.
That makes, that I structure to me is, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Because Ayala sort of thrown away said, you know, it's about 5 minutes. If you want to do impressions and characters, like three impressions, three characters. And I just heard that and said, yes, 5 minutes, three.
Oh, and you're not a character guy. So you did 3 29-year-old.
No, I went to work.
Oh, you
I went
did.
To work. And I used it. I mean, I think that the one thing about SNL auditions is that you can show off writing. Like you can write jokes within your stuff.
Right.
So I think I did Russell Crowe and Hugh Grant. Again, we're talking about 2000 here. So they were very of the moment.
Hugh Grant, you did a few times, didn't you?
I did them like once.
Oh, just once?
Yeah, I did them once.
Yeah.
And then I did, you know, I wrote like a Boston guy.
Oh, yeah?
And
how are you?
Yeah. It was a guy who was upset.
I'm
about.
Upset.
Yeah, there you go. You got it. This is all of it. You've seen it. It got around.
What yeah, about this guy?
I made a very unique choice to do an upset Boston guy. But, and then I thought that was the end of it. And then 6 months later, they reached out again for another tape. And it was funny.
Hugh Grant, Russell Crowe, upset Boston guy.
Yeah. This actually was a sketch once. It was a fallen from grace Italian fashion photographer who now worked at Sears.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I did that with Hugh Jackman. We did it together.
And you did the Italian accent?
Yeah, it was fine.
Okay.
Well, not great, but fine.
Yeah.
And then, so that it was a second tape, send that in, and then about, after a full year, probably about after they first reached out, I got called in to audition.
So you kind of, like, it's. I've heard that before, where you just sort of let it go.
And I completely let it go.
Yeah, and you go back to pickups and hiccups.
Yeah.
Guys are kicking ass.
I moved out here, actually. I came out to L.A. and went
with
through...
With Jill?
With Jill and with Josh, my brother. And we went... We had a place on, like, Vermont.
Wait, Josh was in Amsterdam with you, right?
Yep. And then he flew back from Amsterdam for a pilot season. He ended up going back for a year after.
Okay.
And before he fully moved out. But we lived in, like, a furnished apartment and went through one pilot season. And it was during that I got the call to... So I lived out here for all of 6 months before.
Did you get a pilot?
No, I did one episode of Spin City with Charlie Sheen, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And then when the whole Charlie Sheen thing happened, I had forgotten that was my first time on TV. It was like 2 months into the Charlie Sheen meltdown that all of a sudden I had the memory of, oh, that was...
Yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, I did a scene with him. He was very nice. Could not
what
have
happened
been nicer.
To that kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So, you go back. So, then what's next? So, you get the second call for another tape, or you got to go to the studio
two
now?
Two tapes. Now, I go to the studio. I fly out, and I had a friend of a friend, knew Rachel Dratch. I asked if I could call her. I called her. She was absolutely lovely. This was before I'd ever met her.
Yeah.
And she
was on the show at that time?
She was on the show. She gave me advice about auditioning, which is the advice I still give people all the time, which is the best thing you can tell them is nobody laughs, because then if you even just get one laugh, you think you broke.
Right. You can delude yourself.
Yeah.
That, yeah.
And I did my audition, and I thought it went really well.
Yeah.
And I don't usually think that.
You didn't get laughs. You did.
I did. I did. I got enough laughs on... I think I got my laughs more on the jokes than on the performance, mm-hmm. but enough laughs that I thought, oh, that went well.
Yeah.
And flew back to L.A., then got a call that Lauren wanted to meet me, flew all the way back to New York, and had my, you know.
Your one-on-one?
My one-on-one.
With Lauren? How long did you wait?
I waited probably an hour plus.
Yeah.
Shoemaker and Higgins came out and said hi.
Yeah.
Sat down. Lauren, I didn't realize I'd been hired. Yeah. That's how pessimistic I am.
You thought this was just part of the process. Well, it is part of the audition process usually, isn't
it? Yeah, but even in the... He didn't say you're hired over that meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, like, do you think you could work in New York? And then he said, you know, I think we'll bring you in and see how you look in wigs. And so I left thinking, well, now all I have to do is the wig
the
stage.
Wig challenge.
And then I flew all the way back to LA before I got a call that, you know, I was officially going to start.
See how you look in wigs.
And by the way, he should have, because I look terrible in wigs.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, Bill Hader, transformative. Put a wig on him, different guy.
Yeah, I think I've heard someone else say that.
Yeah.
That they said, I think it might have been Hader. Like, you know, it was a question that he would ask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, whereas I just look like a guy in a wig.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Always.
Well, Hader's like one of those guys, it seems like if he held something in his hand that was had enough juice, he could transform into it.
It's really... I mean, that was... When those guys started showing up, Hader, Sandberg, Sudeikis, before them, Fred and Will, that was when I had my real crisis of confidence of, oh, I'm not as good as they are.
Uh-huh.
And I like them that personally, but I'm deeply jealous of how good they are.
Yeah, and there's nothing... Well, it's that weird humility of moving through jealousy to realizing your limitations.
Yeah.
It's brutal.
Oof.
Yeah. Like, because, like, you sit there, like, you like that moment where you realize, like, there's nothing I could do.
That was... I mean, I remember the year 4 or 5 was really rough for me on that
show.
Well,
who was there when you got there?
When I get there, last year of Will.
Yeah.
Catan.
Yeah.
Valentina.
2001.
2001.
Yeah.
Tracy Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
I start with Polar, which is a lifesaver because we got to be really good friends. And she was sort of, she instantly worked on the show.
Yeah.
As would make sense to anybody who knows her talents. And it was good to be friends with somebody who was working.
Did you write for her?
I did.
Yeah.
And I wrote with her a lot.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun writing together.
So you were one of those guys where you get brought on as a writer cast member.
Just a cast member. Every cast member writes, but I wasn't credited as a writer.
So you start doing that on your own initiative with her. At some point you realize, like, I'm not getting on. I'm going to work with Amy.
Well, it was more like I would write things that were group scenes.
Yeah.
That I would have a good line or two in. Like that's how I was trying to stay alive. Whereas if I wrote a Seth scene.
Yeah.
They were unsustainable.
But that was just instinctual. It wasn't like calculated.
I think it was more instinctual than
right. Like, I got to get on. They're not going to give me the whole scene.
Yeah.
So maybe I could just be this guy.
It wasn't for lack of trying.
Right.
I mean, I did try to be the guy in the scene. There's a weird thing where when you get hired for SNL, you have this initial like burst of confidence because you think they can't be wrong.
Right.
If they said you should be here, you're about to be Will Ferrell.
Right. Right.
They must know something.
They'll make
you don't.
Into that.
Yeah. And then over the course of that first year, you realize, oh no, like this is.
Yeah.
They can be wrong.
Yeah, and they can grind you down to nothing.
Yeah.
And make you go running away feeling like an empty vessel.
Yes, all of those things could have happened.
So, all right, so 2001, 2002, you write with Amy, you get on a little bit. A
little bit.
And then Will leaves?
Will leaves.
In 2000 and when?
Yeah, that was, 2002 season. Yeah. And that's not, so then that's Forte and Fred. No, yeah, Forte and Fred start the next year.
Uh-huh.
And they're kind of immediately like these really unique voices.
Yeah.
And that you just kind of watch other people at the table like light up when they do their sketches because they're like, I've never seen anything like this. and I'm looking at these faces saying, I've never seen these expressions. Where were these expressions for my first year? And
so you're quietly smiling and steaming inside.
Just yeah.
Fuming.
And also, you know, that thing of knowing, being so aware of your own jealousy.
Yeah. How did you not see the difference between, I guess, you and me is that I wouldn't have been able to hide it nor keep it to myself.
I would have
started a gossip campaign just out of my own fucking anger and fear and just be like, nah, fuck Fred. Was there any of those guys around? Fuck Armisen.
We were there at a pretty good era. I don't think there were a lot of fuck people,
Fred,
fuck
oh,
cast
really?
Member, like right. fuck this guy, yeah, fuck yeah. that guy. You know, Mike Shoemaker, who now I work with at Late Night, he was a producer at SNL.
Was he a head writer or he was?
No, he was just on the producer side.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, it was Tina. Was the head writer
from 2001?
Pretty much, yeah.
And that's when you really met her?
Yeah. Her and Dennis McNicholas was a head writer. But Shoemaker was one of these guys. He was like a real good friend to me right away. And he was the guy that kept me from making any of the mistakes that would have ruined my time there. I'm really lucky to have him and everyone.
Like he'd pull you out of the crew when you were about to cry and stuff?
Or just say like, hey, you know, like this don't, you can't be jealous. You,
right.
Like these, you're going to work with these people for a really long time.
Yeah.
You can't, you have to figure out a way to make it work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you listened to him?
I did. I'm a very good listener when I get good advice.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good.
Because I'm looking for it.
Jealousy did not contaminate your perception in a way, because you like I don't know, like, well, obviously I'm like I have problems, but like I would have been like, what the fuck do you know? But you were like, no, I want to stay here.
No, because yeah, I did want to stay, and also I kind of, you know, the saddest I ever was at my time at SNL was when I came to this realization of if they fired me, I couldn't say they were wrong about it.
This was 2004. So you've been biting your lip for a long time and trying to figure out how to work it. And you're just, you're getting in a little bit,
Little bit. I was getting sketches on, you know, I was writing. And this ended up—
Were you credited as a writer at that point?
No. So what happened was when Tina left, Lauren asked if I wanted to be head writer.
Just out of nowhere.
Pretty much out of nowhere.
2004?
2005, I want to say.
So after the crisis.
It kind of saved me from the crisis.
Right.
Because I thought, oh, well then, this will be the thing I am.
So you showed that you had, an even keel and could manage content.
Yeah, and that I would, I could write for a lot of different voices.
Right.
Some people are very good at writing things for themselves.
Yeah.
And not others, but I think like I had a good ear for people and could figure.
And everybody spoke highly of you, and you were delivering sketches, and Lauren knows that.
Yeah, and
he knows who writes what.
Yeah, our names are on them.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful.
Yeah.
And
but you weren't credited as a writer yet.
No, but when you turn in sketches at the table read, everybody, your name is on the top.
Do you get writer money?
No.
Hmm.
It's weird.
Mm.
Yeah. I was very upset for it. I was very upset about that in the years that I was
uncredited as a writer.
Yeah, because I like being a writer. Like I'm one. Like Lauren always makes fun of me that I was the only cast member who was so happy to get a writer's credit. Like, you know, he was
really?
Like, usually people angle the other way.
Yeah,
but I really wanted that.
Well, you knew the you. This is a great personal journey where you realized your own limitations. That you realized that that your talent was what it was, and you could use it within your reason. But writing was your strong suit. And that if anything, if the other stuff went, you could be a writer on some level.
Yes, absolutely. That's always, I would thought, okay, this will be.
Right.
And I really love doing it. So, I mean, my favorite moments at SNL, the moments that I remember, like, were more often than not me standing on behind the cameras watching people do something, watching like something murder that I wrote.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You're a good audience, and that's exciting.
Yeah, it's
because you're waiting.
Yeah, just waiting and knowing, and that thing of
this is that line.
Yeah, and also the, my first couple years on the show, I'll watch reruns, and the stage managers had to tell me to stop. I would move my mouth during other people's lines if I wrote it.
Oh, really?
I couldn't get out of my writer's brain. So
yeah, that's a weird habit. Not everybody. It's a unique thing.
I would do it at update too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like if,
sitting next to somebody.
Yeah, I have no idea, but I would be moving my mouth along.
You were on with Tina?
No, Tina left.
Oh, that's you were on with Amy? Who were you? Who was your?
Yeah, so it was Jimmy and Tina. Jimmy left. We had SNL audition.
Did you write for Jimmy a lot?
No, I didn't really. I mean, we wrote a couple things together.
Yeah.
We weren't there very long.
But you see each other now. You're in the same building, right?
You'd be surprised how little we see each other just because.
You tape at different times?
Tape at different times on different floors. And
right.
When you're at different floors of a giant sky rise.
I was just on a show.
Yeah, how'd it go?
It was good.
Great.
It was the first time I'd done his Tonight Show, but Lauren came down to say hi.
Oh, really?
Crazy.
That's really great.
It's so crazy.
Here's what's crazy.
What?
That means Lauren's come and said hi to you more recently than he's come and said hi to me.
I was just so like, I never, like, I feel weird that it's so exciting.
Yeah.
But I don't know him. Like my experience with him is one bad meeting and then my interview with him.
Sure.
And that's it. But during that interview, I was able to see him in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's a guy that works there.
Yeah. He just works there.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do still, he doesn't stop by that much.
Right.
Which is fine.
To the new show.
Yeah. But when he does, it is always really nice.
Yeah.
He just does that thing of like, everything good?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Do you get the sense that he's paying attention?
Yeah. I don't know how much he's paying attention, but right. I think he's been very good over the course of almost, well, I guess, a year and a half. I hope that's right. But he, of just letting me know how he thinks it's going or you know. He's the kind of guy who wants you to make small adjustments and,
uh-huh.
you know.
Well, let's get to that in a second. So now you're like, you've been offered the head writer thing and you're the head writer. And what does that mean for your performing? Did you find yourself on the show less or more as
less.
Head writer? Right.
Yeah. So now I'm a head writer.
With who?
So I'm still a little bit of overlap with Tina and then Andrew Steele, who works out here now and does a bunch of stuff with Funny or Die.
Yeah. I knew his wife.
Kiki.
Kiki used to, I wonder if Kiki still hates me. Kiki used to be a producer on my short attention span theater.
Gotcha, wow.
And I was a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And she just did not, I didn't know how to play the game. I didn't want to be there really. I took the job because I had nothing else going on. And you know, in retrospect, I learned how to read prompter. I did a lot, but
sure.
But I was not nice to her. And I don't, like, I imagine, like, I don't think I make as big an impression as I do. Like, in everything,
right.
time fades everything.
Yeah.
But I had heard at some point that, like, I was, like, the bane of her existence.
You have the best memory of your worst behavior.
Sure. And you think you have this impact, but there's a narcissism to that. You're like, hey, man, I really got to apologize for that thing. And they're like, what?
Yeah. Hey, have you bounced back from me?
Yeah.
Have you recovered?
I haven't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then Tina leaves, and then... I auditioned for to be an update with Fuller.
Okay, did Lauren say we're going to audition?
Yeah, we had auditions. And also, Lauren sort of threw back channels. Not back channels, it was pretty specific. But my manager at the time called and said, hey, next season, Lauren thinks you should just be a writer and not a cast member.
This is before the update audition?
Yeah. And that was a decision in my head where I thought, I think if I don't get update, I'm gonna leave. Because I thought it was the one, because again, I had all this awareness that these people are better than me.
Yeah.
They're better than me. I'm jealous of their talents.
Yeah.
I did think I was the right choice for update.
Right.
And I kind of
thought. Who else was up for it?
I feel like
everybody.
Keenan auditioned, a couple of other writers auditioned. Yeah. And
that's just in the audition, you're in the studio at the desk with Amy,
just
doing camera tests.
Just doing jokes.
Yeah.
I wrote something. I used to do the thing with Amy called Really, which I wrote one of those for that.
Yeah.
To be like, oh, this, maybe it'll be like this. And so anyways, I basically like went into that audition being like, this is either, I'll either get this or it's the end of it. So that was the biggest thing that ever happened to me at SNL, obviously.
And, getting update.
Yeah. And then that also turned me into... it just allowed me to be so magnanimous because now all of a sudden as a performer, after years of struggle, I'm going to get 15 minutes every week.
Yeah.
Doing the one thing I'm comfortable being, which is myself.
Right.
And now I can just like redouble my efforts to sort of help everybody else with my extra energy.
Really?
Yeah.
So you stayed on as head writer and did update.
And I think that I mean, it was just because... of ego and like finally having that moment,
but it's confidence. Your work had paid off in that piece of the puzzle was set for the time being. And you know, so now you like, you know, you achieved something.
Yeah. And I was so, and it was the first thing. Cause again, I don't think I'm alone, but you feel like a fraud a lot of times at SNL, like, oh, they made a terrible mistake. And I was all of a sudden like
How many years into it though? This is like six years
in.
You feel like a fraud until you get update?
I mean, there were some.
I'm really getting away with something.
There were some drunken rides home from like after parties and taxis where I was just, oh no, this is, I got to have fun at these parties because I don't think they're going to last. I think this is going to be end soon. And then what's great. And that was why I wasn't really thinking of what I was going to do next because I was so happy doing update every week and being a head writer. And I do think, you know, that cast that I got to write for and that whole writing staff got to write for, I do think that's one of the sort of top three groups of people that have ever been.
And that was who? His Hader.
So that's Wig, Hader, Kohler, Maya, Sandberg, Fred, Will, Keenan.
They're all very nice people.
It's a good group.
But so your relationship with Lauren was, you know, he must have liked your even keelness and like,
yeah.
and you know, practical listening person.
Yeah, and I was the kind of person who was willing to fix problems that Lorne had.
Oh, yeah?
I liked...
he'd come to you as a writer and he'd go, I don't think this is working.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the head writer's main job is sort of, you know, the things that... Because, again, it's that great place where... On Tuesday, everybody just goes off and writes their own thing. So yeah. If somebody brings something brilliant, as a head writer, you have nothing to do with that. You're just lucky.
Right.
And then it's like when Friday rolls around, like, what are the cracks? And oftentimes those are cold opens or monologues or, you know, we're an update feature.
Celebrity
short.
Monologue? You mean guest star monologue? Yeah.
Those are really tough to crack sometimes.
Uh-huh. Because you don't know if this person can even deliver jokes sometimes.
Oftentimes, by the time it's a problem, you know they can't. You know, it's Friday, and now you've seen enough of them to know that they can't.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're holding on to the idea that they can.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
I will, and I know that this has now become sort of an SNL trope that people don't like, but I loved question monologues.
Yeah.
Where people in the audience would stand up and ask questions, because then it's just, you know, you take six of them to dress, and if four of the questions work, and
right.
And there were hosts who took that as an insult.
Oh, really?
I just feel like you obviously don't think that I can do a monologue if you have people in the audience asking me a question.
Uh-huh.
It was that. But the real question was, why do you think you can do a monologue?
You can't ask that question.
Yeah.
There's no delicate way to do
right.
that. So the head writer's job at SNL was to primarily, you know, collate... the different, all the stuff that comes in, decide which was great, figure out which stuff needed work, and then, you know, after the first read-through, listen to Lorne's suggestions.
Yeah, well, the best part, I loved it. I probably am now romanticizing it, but we would do rewrite tables on Thursday, which is the writing staff would sit around a table, and you would have the sketches that had already been selected for the show, and you would basically rewrite them. Just adding jokes, making cuts, and it was just sitting in a room with really fucking funny people.
Who was there when you were there? The writers.
I mean, James Anderson, Paul Appel, Emily Smivey, John Mulaney, Marika Sawyer, Simon Rich. Colin Jost, who's doing Update Now, Rob Klein, Eric Kenward, Liz Kikowski. I mean, there were tons of people.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, I was there for so long that anytime I list names, I know I'm leaving out.
Right.
Tons and tons of people.
So you were there for, how did it end for you there? How was the new job? How do you go from head writer, update? I don't remember what happened because I don't keep up with the show that much.
Yeah.
But like what was the evolution to where you are now?
That basically NBC made the move to put Jimmy in the Tonight Show. And so there was an opening. I really hadn't been thinking about it. There was a article in the New York Post that said that I was a front runner for it. I just assumed it was a rumor.
It was a leak. Yeah.
But I talked to Lorne, and there's this weird thing sometimes when you talk to Lorne that you have a phone conversation with him, and it's as if he thinks you had a phone conversation beforehand, and this is the follow-up call.
Yeah.
So he's having a follow-up call to a call that never happened.
Right.
Because I was saying, I made some joke about this thing being in the Post, and Lorne's reaction was, no, Ian, look, I think you'll be good at it, and it was that same thing, much like, here it was, whatever.
That's how you were told, is basically what he's saying. Is that, like, no one ever gets the straight shit from him.
No.
But you find out some weird other way, and then he just is like, oh, good, he knows
it's
now.
It's like, we're going to want to try some ties on you. And then, you know, we'll do the tie test.
No wigs, though.
But no, the wigs. You finally can do your own hair. And then that just sort of started this really fast process, and it was very near the end of the SNL season. And I don't know if this is the right or wrong decision. I was not emotionally prepared. I basically, when I found out about Late Night, I had only one more show left.
Yeah.
And I asked Lorne if I could come back and do the first half of the next season, which I did. What that meant.
At Update.
At Update and head writer. I did it, but then I did it with Cecily Strong for half a year, so that they would help. That would help transition after I left. But that only meant. I was head writing, I was Update. I also had offices downstairs for Late Night. We were hiring staff there. It was probably a time in my life where I was doing too much.
Yeah.
And because I only had 3 weeks between my last SNL and my first Late Night.
And what, now the decision for Fred to do the music direction, that was just sort of goofy or like, you know,
I like music, but I don't have an understanding of it. I certainly had no understanding of what I wanted the music element of this show to be.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly knew we weren't going to be able to provide like sort of the musical expression that like the Roots have on the Tonight Show. We weren't gonna, so we couldn't have a band that wanted to do a million things because that was outside of my skill set. And so we'd gone down a couple of roads, and we didn't really know. Maybe we wouldn't have a band at all. And then Lauren had the idea of Fred, very much with like 2 weeks to go. And I jumped at it. It was just, for me, so nice as a comfort level to have Fred there. And, and he put the band together. And Fred and I have similar music sensibilities, so I really like the way our band sounds.
And you have a lot of guest players come in
yeah,
and
so Fred now, I mean, the reality is with Fred's, and we always knew this too with Fred's schedule and all the things, projects he has. You know, Fred will probably be there about 10 weeks a year, but it's his band, and we have guest drummers every week, and it's really fun.
What were some of the other decisions about the show when you were had this short amount of time to revamp it a little bit, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
So what tonally, what were you thinking?
Well, it was funny how you make all these decisions that are out, like, we're going to do it differently, and how quickly those don't work, because there is, audiences do
they
want
know,
it.
They want the desk.
They do. They really do.
And yeah.
We had this.
Because if you don't have the desk, they're like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
What's happening?
We want it. It's a, it's, again, I know these shows are consumed a lot of different times of the day now, but the people who are watching when it happened, it's like, it's a settled time of the night.
Yeah. No, it's definitely not like, yay!
Yeah. But one thing was, we built something that looked more like a Weekend Update desk. And the idea would be that after the, in the second act of the show.
Yeah.
We'd roll this out, and I would do something very much like those update features, like me and a Stefan type character, for whatever, lack of a better.
Was that a comfort zone thing, or just because you thought that's how you were known? Or?
We thought it would be different, and then as soon as we did it, we realized it was a dud.
Right.
And we had like spent a lot of money to build a desk that I think we used once.
Yeah.
You know, we had a big TV screen, like a 100-inch TV screen that we were going to use as a green screen, and then was just like, no, I don't.
They
know?
Repurposed it over there.
Yo, yeah, they took it back right away. And so we did all these. We sort of did all these things that we thought would make them different. We kind of got rid of them, and then we had sort of a fairly conventional structure. I will say, from the beginning, people would suggest that maybe I start at the desk instead of starting with a
monologue.
A monologue,
yeah.
And it took me. I was resistant to it. Or hesitant to do it because I thought it would look too much like Update.
Right.
And would sort of be me saying, yeah, I can only do that one thing.
And putting stuff on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I kind of came to the conclusion of like, oh, it's not bad to be really good at one thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, that's kind of like what show business
journey,
is.
Journey of you like, realizing your limitations.
Oh, I really, every day I find a new one. It's the best.
Because I remember seeing you do stand-up, and then like you don't do that anymore there?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't do a standing monologue anymore.
No, you don't.
No. And it's nice. And the other nice thing is, you know, we follow The Tonight Show an hour earlier, and I'm sure 95% of our audience are people who watch The Tonight Show first.
Uh-huh.
So they've just seen a guy do a standing monologue an hour earlier.
Yeah, and a lot of bells and whistles on that show.
Well, that's a big show. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I know. It's like there's a lot of things. There's pranks.
Yeah.
There's games.
It is a, they want to make a big show, and God love them. It's fantastic to be on after a big show.
Right.
Especially if you want to be a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And
but that's also historically what happens.
Yeah.
Right.
And we realized, oh, we should just try to get to our first joke so much faster. And so now we have a very short opening package, probably the shortest of any talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And it just opens with me at the desk, and I just start telling jokes, and I do like 15 jokes at the desk with graphics, and that allows you to do them a lot faster.
Right.
And we sort of get like 12 or 15 minutes in that first act that's all day of writing, and hopefully we hold as much of that audience as we can.
And who's writing with you?
Alex Bays, who was the head writer at Weekend Update.
Yeah.
I was the one guy I brought over with me. And we put together a great group of writers. We got guys that were improvisers in Chicago, people who wrote for The Onion, people who were stand-ups.
Yeah.
And we just kind of, most of them, it was their first job in TV.
And how'd you take to the guest interviews?
I dig it.
Yeah.
I thought it would be the hardest part. And when it starts, I feel like my job is over. Those interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I like listening to people, and I like talking to him. It's just not, it's, I thought it'd be so hard, and it's really, it, I mean, I'm sure every now and then you have one that's a,
yeah, it's like, uh-oh, I gotta work.
The hardest thing is, especially in this era where, you know, I do a lot of, most of the interviews I listen to are things like this that are so much longer.
Right.
how short 7 minutes is.
How do you do it? Oh, no, it's crazy. I don't know how you do it, how you would do that. I mean, I can't do anything in 7 minutes.
It's hard.
Because, well, you guys, you don't freewheel, right? You segment produce.
We segment produce. I mean, I will say every now and then,
yeah,
you know, you'll have somebody who doesn't want to do a pre-interview.
Yeah.
And I like that. It's exciting, going in that way.
Well, Jimmy was doing that a bit when he did that spot where I remember doing the late night with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the first times, like, because Kimmel did it too, you know, with his show, where it was just sort of, it's like, you know, you're going to talk about the thing. You're all right.
Yeah.
And, like, I was so used to Conan where, you know, you'd, what stories you got? What do you got? How's he going to lead you? But the idea of just sort of like, just go out there. He'll take care of it. And I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of exciting because for me, it was sort of unheard of after, you know, 2 decades of doing produced segments.
Mm-hmm.
But it is kind of interesting if the person can handle it.
It is. I mean, the risk is we try really hard not to edit our interviews.
Right.
So, you know, there is this thing of we could talk. I'm sure I could talk to anybody for 15 minutes and have 7 great minutes. But I do feel like you can tell when a late night interview is edited.
Yeah. I think
and so,
so
we try to have that feeling of like this was as live as we could make it 5 hours before you saw it.
Right. Well, there's that the idea that you only have 7 and if you just freewheel it, like it might not have an arc to it. It might just kind of, you know, doesn't feel like, you know, you're just getting into it. You don't want that to be the end of the interview where it's like, you didn't even talk about anything.
Well, that. The fun thing is, I feel like you prepare an interview,
And
then if you get somebody and you realize they're perfectly happy freewheeling, then you can just kind of throw the interview.
And also, you got a lot of friends in the business, so like there are guys you have relationships with, and that always makes it easier and fun, right?
It does, yeah. The interesting thing, though, is some people really do want to have their 8 beats.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're selling something.
Of course. Or they just like to
get laughs.
They don't want to risk.
Yeah, yeah. I got good bits. Let's do them.
And it's funny. I mean, there's a. I'm doing these shows. You realize there are 200 different kinds of talk show guests, and the longer you do the show, the more you can like clock them quickly.
Yeah.
Because some people just come out and they don't look at you once. They just like play out.
Right.
And they're here for the people, and that's great too.
I never thought of that. I do that a lot.
But that's a good way to do it.
Well, I mean, I do, but I'll check in. Like, as soon as the joke doesn't go as good, I'm like, so Conan, what's up? Where were you? It's your job to save me. That's your job. You're supposed to fill in here.
Fantastic.
Do you ever have that sense where you're watching somebody and the joke doesn't go and you realize, like, I got to pull this back around?
Yeah. the worst is when I can't then come up with something to save it. And so I do the awful, like, gear shift of, now I want to talk to you about...
It didn't come. You wanted something.
Yeah. I also try not to look at cards during the interview.
On the desk?
Yeah. There are, and every now and then I like while asking the question, we'll sort of forget what I'm asking. Oh. And it's just that like, you know, like a kid giving an oral report who's trying to run out the clock.
Right.
And, you know, and this is something that in the times that I've been, and then you'll remember, and then you realize that what you're setting up isn't the question. And then your work is, you just went to Italy.
I got it.
Yeah. That was all horseshit. Everything I was saying was horseshit.
Oh, that's funny. So every night, huh?
Yeah.
Where do you live?
I live in Manhattan. I live in the West Village, yeah.
Oh, I thought you got it. Did you get another place?
No.
Oh, it's just all there?
Yeah.
Right in the fucking village?
Yeah.
And you got a baby now?
Yeah.
How old's the baby?
7 weeks today.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So what are you doing in LA?
Just out for a day.
For this?
For this. And I did a panel for this show Documentary Now, the one I do on
Oh, that's
IFC.
Right. Well, that show is, that's fun. How did, like, what, because you, do you write on that? Are you part of the conceptual part of it? So it's you and Fred and Bill.
And the two directors, Alex Buono and
Reese
Thomas.
Is that the guy from Portlandia? Are those guys?
No. They did a lot of they do SNL short films, commercial parodies and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And really good at like grasping genre and style. Mulaney's writing on it as well.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
So once you decide the period you're working with and the tone of it, you just kind of stay within it.
Yeah, we just try to pick things that we feel like would both be fun characters for Bill and Fred to play and also fun styles for the directors to mess around with.
Yeah. And how many, you've done 8?
We did 6 the first season. We're doing another 6 now.
But all right, so let's talk about this Albuquerque connection. You spend time in my hometown now.
Yeah, I do.
Like a lot, because your in-laws are there? Is that the deal?
Yeah, I married a girl from from Albuquerque.
Who's younger than, much younger than me, but yeah. You say her family kind of knows who my, well, my dad's still there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They're Jews. I married Jews.
Yeah.
And again,
how's that feel? Familiar? Good? Not?
It was like a completion of this cycle of, I'm not, like years of telling people I'm not Jewish and then just basically like giving
And then
it.
Your in-laws saying like, just keep that to yourself. You're Jewish now.
Yeah. I did a show actually for, like a fundraiser in Albuquerque
for
some Jewish federation there. And I was like, oh, this is full circle.
You did it. Yeah. You've paid your respects.
I paid my respects.
So what part of town do you go to when you're
They're
there?
They're Placidus.
Oh, God, that's fucking crazy because, like, when I was a kid, Placidus was, like, this weird, beat-up hippie community.
Well, they're weird hippies.
Oh, okay, so they've been there a while.
Yeah, they went out a long time ago.
Oh, they're original Placidus settlers.
Yeah, I think they are.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So they would have, like, maybe known of my dad, but I bet you they know, like, there was, like, my buddy Devin Jackson, his old man was a doctor, kind of the hippie doctor at the college, and I think they lived in Placidus for a couple years.
Gotcha.
Dr. Dennis Jackson.
All right, I'll check.
I'm throwing him some love, even though my buddy Devin doesn't talk to him much anymore. But so when you go to Albuquerque, that's still a little out. Do you go into the city? Do you eat at Frontier? Do you do anything?
I've eaten at Frontier, yeah.
It's worth it, right?
We go to the Range. That's the one we go to up in Placidus all the time.
I don't know that one. Like, is Placidus developed now?
Yeah, but you still have to, like, drive to... I mean, if you really want to go out for dinner, you're probably going to Albuquerque.
Or Santa Fe. Yeah. But Santa Fe is like 40 minutes, right? Mm-hmm.
But and then I was also out there because they shot MacGruber, Will Forte's movie MacGruber in Albuquerque. So I spent a summer out there for that.
A lot of shooting there now.
Yeah.
Where'd you meet the Albuquerque girl?
I met the Albuquerque girl at Chris Kattan's wedding. So her older sister worked at SNL in the set department. My wife's a lawyer. She's not in show business at all.
Yeah.
But I went to Chris Kattan's wedding, and I knew her older sister very, like, not well.
Yeah.
Pretty well. But, and there was this this girl, Alexi, there, and over, we, like, were a wedding hookup that then turned into a wife and a baby.
I saw Chris Kattan on a plane recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that, and I should get in touch with him. You guys friends still?
Yeah, Chris Kattan came to our wedding, because, again, we met at his wedding.
Yeah.
And Chris Kattan... It was the greatest gift at a wedding because he got up at the rehearsal dinner to give a toast. And it was just so obvious that the toast would be how we met at his wedding.
Yeah.
And instead, he told a story about when I first started at SNL, he and I went out with two girls.
Uh-huh.
And the girl I was with had a herpes. And so, and again, this is not my memory of the story. Yeah. So instead, Seth just grabbed her boobs.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things that the everybody knew we met at the wedding.
Yeah.
At his wedding. And
he wouldn't do it.
It was, and I just got it. I mean, I don't even think he knew. And I got up and I took the mic and I was like, thank you so much, Chris. Because Chris said, I want to tell the story about how you met at my wedding. And I said, no, Chris. So, and the next day in my wedding vows, I brought it up again. It was just the gift that kept giving. And, you know, Kattan's with guys just walking around at the wedding going like, what? What did I do?
Do you keep in touch with, like, a lot of the people, though, like, from the years of SNL? Like,
I
like knowing that some of you are still friends. Like, who are your friends?
Well, I'm really close with Andy and Poehler and obviously Fred and Bill. I see a lot. Sudeikis, I run into. Forte. I mean, these are all people.
But Andy's like a buddy.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah, Andy's really...
I just interviewed his wife a couple weeks ago. She's genius.
Genius. I agree with you.
Like a savant of some kind.
He is... it's really funny, too, that someone that makes that sort of beautiful lyric music, like, married our greatest purveyor of dick songs.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just perfect.
Well, it's just so funny. I went to see her in concert, and he was up in a booth, and I just saw him just sort of, like, in awe.
Yeah.
Of, like, you know, like,
he genuinely is in awe of his wife. It's so great.
It's pretty amazing.
But I'm friends with those guys. You know, one of the things that's so heartbreaking is I kind of thought when I was at SNL, I daydreamed that we would all just, like, live in New York forever.
Yeah.
And the reality is there's just not that many jobs out there. And so everybody came out here. And, I don't see them as much as I want to.
But, you know, you got New York, and I guess it's fun if you got the bread to live there, it's a nice place to live.
The bread helps.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me, Seth.
Of course.
How'd this go as an interviewer?
I thought it was fantastic. It's nice to be on this side a little bit.
Yeah, good. Well, it was good talk. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Okay, that was nice. Me and Seth Meyers. Nice fella. Funny guy. Knows himself. How do you like that? Oh, pow. I just shit my pants with some cold press. Just coffee.coop. Yeah, I just did that.
fucked up at the end. I'm not a professional.